This is the third of the series, and as you can see, the title is The Hidden Fourth Pillar of the Olympic Games, Privatized Profit and Socialized Debt. And we'll see why I mean that, because the official pillars of the Olympic movement, of course, are, as one might expect, because it's the Olympic sports, and then they tossed in sometime in the past, they tossed in culture, and we know there's a cultural Olympiad that's associated with the Games. And about 10 years ago, they decided that they really had to make the Olympics green, so they made the third pillar of Olympism environmental conservation. What these actually mean is another thing, but we'll discuss that. And I would suggest that the hidden fourth pillar that they don't talk about, because they don't want to introduce that, is the whole notion of privatized profit and socialized debt. And I want to launch into that by opening the general discussion about what is corruption really. Corruption is not merely match fixing, and we hear a lot about match fixing in European football and Asian football and also in other places. The doping that occurs not only in sports, but the doping that also occurs in the Olympic Games and the bribery that occurs in these things. But corruption is when, in my view, when a society is sold on the merits of the games by a group of people who have something to achieve through them, and the consequences of what happens when a society goes down the path towards the Olympic adventure, and especially when they've been deliberately misled about the things that are going to transpire, things that the same politicians and organizers know full well what's going to happen. So the topics we're going to talk about in the next 40 minutes are one I've tried to address in other forums, and one that you're going to hear over and over again as we get closer to the games. Do the Olympics or other mega sporting events, do they actually contribute in a positive way to the economy? And especially, and that's a general statement, does it help the city in which it's held? Does it help the region at large? Does it help the entire country? And moreover, if you are in an economic bad time, in a recession such as we are now, is this going to bail you out? Is this going to be an economic panacea? And that's, of course, the kind of thing that our current finance minister, Colin Hanson, likes to say is, thank God we have the Olympic Games, because without them we'd be in big trouble. And they're saying the same thing in London, of course, and they're saying it elsewhere. So is it really true? And we can get some lessons from the current economic crisis and the things that are going on in the Western world, particularly as means to address the economic crisis. Is the Olympics the equivalent of that? I want to talk a little bit about the Olympic frame and see what it's really about. There's an official Olympic frame that we've all heard most of our adult lives, but maybe it's really not about improving the economy, and maybe it's not even really about sports for that matter. What is it about, and who profits? We'll talk about Vancouver's experience in the 2010 Games, focusing on the financial aspects, but also those other costs, because the costs are not merely financial. When you do a full cost-benefit analysis, you're not only looking at the dollars and cents of it, you're also looking at the social impact, you're looking at the environmental impact, and you're looking at the security impact. These things all have value. They may or may not have dollar value, but they have value. And if you're doing a true cost-benefit analysis, they have to be considered. And we'll then touch briefly on what's happening in London 2012, because there is a cautionary tale that's emerging from London 2012 that's remarkably similar to what happened in Vancouver and what could have happened in Chicago's bid, which, fortunately for the people of Chicago, failed last Friday. And then some conclusions in summary. So the general questions that I would pose when looking at an economic question of this nature is, for example, let's take a very broad picture. Is Obama's stimulus package in the United States, is it working? And I would answer that it's probably too early to tell. Okay? And is it the equivalent, let's say, what happened in the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt and his works program, spending a lot of money to jumpstart the American economy in that period? And if it is working, is the Olympic Games the functional equivalent of this? In other words, are all the jobs and the construction projects and the economic stimulus that's developed, is it going to generate that sort of economic outcome that a major stimulus package might do for the economy? What about if you build different kinds of infrastructure? Is a hospital the equivalent of a luge run, or better, or worse? Who benefits in either case? Is it the private sector who makes it, or society who makes the benefit? And a big issue in economic times, hard times, or any times, really is job creation. If you build an Olympic infrastructure, is that the most labor-intensive thing you can do? Or is it the most capital-intensive thing you can do? Those are very different things. For example, restoring old buildings, repaving highways, those kinds of things are things that might have a different impact than building, let's say, a luge run or a Nordic trail or the things that may be of use to a very small fraction of the population. Some more questions. If let's just make the very broad assumption. Let's say it's actually true. I'm going to dispute this assertion, but let's say it's actually true that having an Olympics in Vancouver or London or Chicago or Beijing or wherever actually helps that city. Does it help the surrounding area? In other words, will areas outside of Vancouver see any economic benefit? Will larger areas, will whole countries see any economic benefit? Okay. Or will the economic activity, such as it is, be focused on that area to the detriment of other areas? If Olympics boosts tourism, as it's purported to do, is that a sustainable boost? Does Olympic tourism go on into the future? Or do you create a transient tourist increase and infrastructures that lie empty after the Olympics? What happens if you have pandemics or terrorism or the threat of them? Does that impact that tourism that may or may not come? And the spending that you do during times of low economic activity, how does that impact the future? How does that impact your ability to buy things and spend on things you may need in your society in the future? And I would argue, again, that spending on healthcare and education would actually yield much higher rates of return in the long term for all of society than spending on Olympic-specific items. So this is a slide I like to give from time to time because as part of shifting the frame, you must see these several times a week. I see them several times a day. And this is something known as the Nigerian banking scam. Now, the Nigerian banking scam always starts out in much the same sort of way. Dear beloved friend, someone you don't know is now introducing themselves to you, and they're contacting you because they've heard from a friend or a relative or someone you both know that you're a really reliable, good person, and you can help them out. So you came across your contact email, etc. And so this is a person who's got some money in the bank, and they want to share it with you. And the reason they want to share it with you is they've got some sort of problem. They have this large bank account. They can't get it out of the country, and they need to be able to get it out of the country because their government is going to do something horrible with it. They're going to take this money away from these guys, and they're going to go use it to kill orphans or pull the wings off of butterflies or whatever they're going to do with it. So they need your help. If you can help them take the money out of this country and put it in your bank account, you can do two good things. One, you can help keep those bad things from happening in this country, and B, wow, you get to get rich too because you get to keep half, and all you have to do is open up your bank account and give them your PIN number. Wow, so that's so easy. And I think we all know what happens if you do that. So what I'm going to argue is that the Olympic ideals and the Nigerian banking scam were functionally the same thing. That rather than just impoverishing us one at a time, if we're stupid enough to fall for the Nigerian banking scam, and people still do, it actually goes after whole cities and regions at a time. So let's look at what the Olympic movement and industry promote. What do they actually say they're about? Well, of course, they are about world peace and the brotherhood and sisterhood of mankind, and using elite sports to achieve that greater goal of making humans interact with each other and work together through that elite medium to actually achieve betterment for all human beings. And what do they promise? They promise your city will be in the glare of the media. 3 billion people will watch it for 17 days. And not only that, not only will your city be in the headlights, but look at the pride you're going to feel. You're doing a good thing. You're promoting these things. That's the first part of the Nigerian banking scam. Remember, the altruism part. And your city gets worldwide attention, and everything is going to flow from that. You're going to make so much money. Tourists are going to come there. They're going to throw money at the restaurants and the businesses. Treasury will overflow with so much money that it will slop over, and it's like the old Milton Friedman-esque notion, if you put enough oats into the horse, some of them are going to come out the other end for the sparrows. So that's what's going to happen. Financial windfalls for all. Treasury will fill up. You can rent your house for $1 billion. You're going to get rich too. Cool. You've got, in this basic frame of the Olympic movement and the industry, you've got the two halves of the Nigerian banking scam. You're doing a good deed and something for you. But maybe there's a different reality. Maybe something else that's going on. And maybe it has to do with the local developers and the pet projects. Maybe it has to do with who's who in the bid core and now Vanock. And maybe it has to do with the nature of the IOC and what they actually make on their Olympic adventures. So let's consider some of the players. This gentleman, his name is Jack Poole. He is the CEO of Vanock. Before that, he was the CEO of the BidCor, which is the organization that brought us the games. And in a candid moment, he has a few, in a candid moment, he got up in front of a bunch of developers, I think it was in Squamish in 2002, and also, unfortunately, some reporters were there. And he said, if the games weren't coming, we'd have to invent something. And what he meant by that, we think, was that they needed some sort of means to get you and me to invest in their private deals. Because all the things that this gentleman had done over the years, and this, by the way, this is his partner in crime, a fellow named David Podmore, who's now the CEO of Concert Properties. Concert Properties, before it was Concert Properties, was something called Greystone, which was trying to get the convention center downtown and was trying to do different deals. And before that, it was something called Vancouver Land Corporation, which managed to get the city of Vancouver to sell them for $10 a 99-year lease on almost 100 acres of property along waterfront land. One councillor at the time, Jonathan Baker, called it the greatest land deal since the Dutch bought Manhattan from the Indians for $24 of junk jewelry. Concert Properties, Concert Properties is the new incarnation. Jack managed, in the course of various previous companies he had run, he had lost his investors $3 billion, which you'd think would not be an enormously enticing thing for other people to want to invest in, certainly not to bank this guy the head of a multi-billion dollar project. And yet back in the early 80s, this gentleman was approached by none other than Gordon Campbell. Gordon Campbell was then the mayor of Vancouver, and Gordon Campbell, I think most of you are familiar with his politics and his policies. Gordon Campbell decided that he urgently needed social housing in Vancouver. That was just a priority for him as mayor. And he turned to Jack Poole, who was retiring, and he was retiring because his investors had kicked him out of the companies he'd destroyed, and he said, Jack, I want you to start a new corporation. We're going to call it Vancouver Land Corporation. We're going to fund it with city money, provincial money, and union pension funds, and you're going to run it, and you're going to build social housing. Well, guess what they didn't build? Okay. But anyway, that was the beginning of Vancouver Land Corporation. So what did Concert Properties and its previous incarnations want when they were Greystone? They wanted a new convention center. They tried to push that deal through from way back in this was through the 90s. Ultimately, the NDP government rejected it because the cost was going to be over the top insane. And guess what actually happened? They got their convention center, and the cost was over the top insane. What was supposed to be almost a $480 million project became almost a $900 million project. Okay. They wanted ski resort development in the Callahan Valley. Guess what they're going to get? They wanted developments along the Sea to Sky Highway along the corridor to Whistler. If you've driven that corridor lately, you know that's exactly what's happening up and down the corridor. And, of course, they wanted ultimately to control the Athletes Village, and we know that because these guys actually made a bid on it, even though Mr. Poole had said back before the games were awarded that Concert Properties had no financial interest in anything associated with the Olympics and wouldn't bid on anything. And 2 years later, he put a bid on the village. Other developers, what did they want? They wanted to gentrify the downtown east side. They wanted the same thing, the Sea to Sky corridor enhanced. They wanted to develop, there were many ski resort attempts to try and piggyback on the backs of the Olympics, whether they were in Melvin Creek, also called Shutika, where there's been a blockade since 2000, at Chiam, down in the valley, and at Brome Ridge near Squamish. And, of course, they wanted an airport connector, a new subway line from the airport to downtown Vancouver. And these items, the new convention center, the Sea to Sky Highway upgrade, and the RAB, or Canada Line Connector, were all essential to getting the bid. They were considered to be absolute must-haves if we're going to get the bid. So what does the IOC get? Well, the IOC basically gets a lot of money is what they get. They don't pay income taxes on this planet, anyway. They don't pay income taxes in Canada, the host country. The federal government snuck a clause into the 2007 federal budget that made them tax-exempt as a nonprofit organization. They don't pay taxes in Vancouver. They don't pay taxes in the province of British Columbia. And they sure as heck do not pay taxes in Switzerland, because Switzerland also curiously considers them a nonprofit organization. They have enormous amount of privilege. Andrew Jennings, who will be speaking later in the series, will tell you about it. And they live like the new kings of the universe. So what's in it for them? A lot of money and a lot of prestige and power. This money, by the way, is unaudited. We don't know what they do with their money. The IOC's official claim is they give 92% of it away to various sporting federations and the international National Olympic committees. But we don't actually know that because nobody audits them. So we don't know what they do with their roughly $2 billion of profit every time they hold an Olympic Games. We have to guess, and that's all it is. Back in 2002, the province of British Columbia got these fellows at a company called Intervistas to write an economic impact report on what the Olympic Games would bring to Vancouver if they are actually held. And so they basically asked what impacts would funded by non-residents of BC, and they also considered also what it would happen in BC if they actually brought the games here. Now I should stress that an economic impact assessment is not the same as a cost-benefit analysis. An economic impact assessment is what's all the good stuff that could happen starting from nothing, going all the way up to extremely good. Okay, and it makes an assumption. One of the assumptions is that tends to be ignored by many, in especially in the media, is the assumption starts with the notion that if you didn't bring the games, nothing else would happen. There would be no other economic development. And that's simply not true. Of course there would be. So this starts from the idea that only the games can generate this sort of outcome. So they basically said, okay, we're going to look at all these levels, and we're going to evaluate them for a whole number of things. The GDP, direct person years of employment, direct wages, direct tax revenues. I want you to remember these numbers because these are kind of important. And they settled on the medium high impacts. They had low, they had medium, they had medium high, and they had high. So let's be cautious. Let's say the impacts of the games are only going to be medium high. So that's how much GDP, that's how many person years of jobs, that's how much direct wages, and that's how much money flows into Treasury. $863 million. No, not trivial, but is it really something that we should be jumping up and down about? There's that problem. Again, they're making the assumption that all of this stuff might not occur in the absence of the games. And at the same time, InterVistas released their study. Two other organizations on the complete different ends of the political spectrum, Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, more on the left, and the Fraser Institute, who you all know is fairly far on the right, both did their own economic studies of the games. And they both concluded that, no, that's not going to happen. Basically, there is very little money to be made in the Olympics if you count all the costs. If you do purely economic impacts and you don't look at all the costs, you don't look at the infrastructure you have to build, you don't look at the super projects that you have to do because the IOC wants them, and you don't look at the security costs, and we'll come back to security costs, you're not going to make any money. And there is a new study that just came out, just released, as far as I know, on last Thursday from Western University that is going to make that point even more clearly. So again, those are your numbers. That's what you could possibly get. And then they estimated tourism from various estimates. Again, there's your kind of medium high. You could get 2.7 million tourists coming to the province of BC during this time. But the caveats, again, are these. Okay, so sure, even if you want to double it and say out of province impact could be as big as the in province. The out of province thing is going to be the one numbers we just saw. The in province thing could be at least as big. So double the numbers you've just heard. But it didn't measure the positive impacts against the costs required to obtain them, as a cost-benefit analysis would do. Okay? And again, cost-benefit analysis, a true cost-benefit analysis, would not only look at the economic numbers, it would consider the impact on the environment, it would consider the impact on the poor, it would consider the impact on things such as what we call opportunity costs. What happens if you don't build it? What if you use that money for something else? So, this is the latest report that was just released, an article called Olympic Caveats, Host Cities Risk Debt and Scandal by Howard Burks, released on October 1st, basically said, if money-making were an Olympic event, no city hosting the Games would win a gold medal, or silver, or bronze. That's a pretty clear statement. And is based on a study by Robert Barney of the Center for Olympic Studies at Western University, who blatantly says there's never been an Olympic Games that has made a profit. And I think Mr. Barney is correct. And that flies in the face of most of the stuff we've been told. We've been told that Los Angeles made a profit. It did, but only if you look at the operating period. We've been told that Calgary made a profit. It made a marginal profit. We've been told that Barcelona got a new port, which it did, but for a huge capital outlay. So these things are highlighted as, this is your Nigerian banking scam. You can make this profit if you only open up your bank account. If you gamble with your money, you can actually make a lot of money. But again, the numbers, if you go back in history and look at across the board, you are very unlikely to do so. In fact, you're likely to lose a lot of money. So let's do a reality check. The promises in 2002, and there were a lot of promises made by the Bidcorp and later by Vanock. We were told that the overall cost to taxpayers, provincial and federal, were going to be something around about $660 million. That was going to be all in, everything. Okay. We were told, Larry Campbell said this, the games won't cost Vancouver one penny. Well, as we'll see, Larry may actually have been telling the truth because it's a little bit more than a penny. But let's say he meant it as not costing anything, as Richard Daley in Chicago just recently told his citizens before his bid got kicked out of the park, that it wouldn't cost Chicagoans a dime. Vanock's business plan had the fundamental assumption, and it was stated in the business plan, which was released, by the way, 3 years late, that the economy will continue to be strong through 2010, which was a kind of an amazing statement to be making at the time, considering that people such as Alan Greenspan had been talking about this irrational exuberance and the problem of the markets, and the problem, furthermore, that the subprime industry was likely to take down the entire real estate industry in North America, as it did. And it's not as if this stuff wasn't known. It's not as if people didn't realize that the economy had real issues, that you could go into a recession. But Vanock, in building his business plan, and this is unusual for a business plan, and I've built business plans before, Vanock, for his business plan, didn't have any range of outcomes. They didn't say, okay, here's how great it could be, here's how bad it could be, and here's the middle course. They had, no, just the happy, happy, joy, joy. Everything's going to be perfect through 2010, leaving aside all this other stuff, and that things, you know, that all it can possibly do, the rose-colored glasses firmly planted on their faces, and that's one option. The other one is that they're lying. And that all of these things can only generate money, and the economy can only improve. These were things that were essential: the Convention Center Airport Connector and the Sea to Sky Highway had to be happened for the Games. IOC told Vanock and the government in no uncertain terms, well, Big Four at the time, no uncertain terms, that they need to be able to get to Whistler faster. Therefore, improve the highway. And as always, organizers bow and immediately go obey the IOC. They were told, for example, that the mega construction projects would boost the economy, but it comes back to our first question, is that the way to build an economy? That it would help the poor and the homeless, and this is the bit of the Milton Friedman-esque oats through the horse feeding the sparrows idea, and that security costs were trivial, nothing, practically free, $175 million, and that they would make sure that native symbols and culture were an integral part of the Games. So what, 7 years later, what do we see? Well, the cost that we know about, and I want to emphasize know about, because we don't know all of the amounts of money spent. What we know about is about $6 billion. Okay. So that's a little bit higher than that. And part of that comes from all these infrastructure projects that they had to build that were essential to getting the Games. Vanock tried to have it both ways. When they issued their business plan, they said, well, these aren't really costs, building those things, but they're legacies. So wait a minute. If they're legacies and someone had to pay for them, how can they not be costs? There's a little bit of sleight of hand going on here. So $6 billion plus, and I say $6 billion plus because there's lots of places for governments of all stripes to hide money, and they do. So for example, how do you cost out the staff time that province and the federal government and the city have put into the Games? When they have their staff working full time in the Games, as they have since 2002, how much is that worth? You can't find out from the city of Vancouver. But that's still a cost. Okay, so $6 billion is the hard numbers we can come up with, the media have come up with, I've come up with, other people have come up with. These are the costs in infrastructure and venues and things. This doesn't even count operating costs. This is all taxpayer money, all of it. The operating costs are 75% private sector, 25% taxpayer money. Okay, infrastructure. Again, convention center doubled in cost. It already flooded once, by the way. And indeed, it was not even needed, because we know from an article that Charlie Smith wrote a few years ago that they couldn't even fill the old one. Convention business in North America has been going down since the beginning of this century, and they weren't filling the old one, so why did they need a bigger one? Well, the Vancouver Board of Trade thought they did. A fellow named Mitt Romney, who ran for president about a year and a half ago, he's the one who essentially rescued the Salt Lake City bid from complete disaster because he wasn't as crooked as the people before him. Basically came up here and got in front of the Board of Trade and said, don't count on the Games to stimulate the economy or increase tourism. Well, from the CEO of the Salt Lake City Games, that's a pretty bold statement to make. They chose to ignore that because they would rather not hear that. And Romney went on to say, well, the reason you have the Games is other things, the intangible things, the feel-good factors. You'll be happier with your city. Your city will be in lights. You'll be so proud. But it's not going to do this. You're not going to make money. You're not going to increase tourism. And he should know, because it didn't in Salt Lake City either. And what, in fact, it does, when you see what they did when they built the RAV line, massive disruption up and down the Cambie Corridor. A lot of businesses who could not take 2 years out to wait for this to end. Some of them went out of business. Some of them were definitely suffering. The homeless population in the same period of time, and this is not all attributable to the Games, but some of it is, went from 600 in 2002. It's approximately 3,000 today. And again, Laura Track is here. She can tell me if I've got the numbers wrong, but I don't think they're too far wrong. And security, which was pegged by none other than Jack Poole at $175 million, an outright fraud to the citizens of this country, is actually closer to a billion. Again, that's an amount we know about. That doesn't count what it probably is. And did they incorporate native symbols and culture in a way that was culturally responsive and in protecting those native symbols and culture? I think rather they exploited them rather dramatically. And then we see headlines like this, and you add it all up, and you get the Olympics is going to cost us. Okay, and this is an article by Daphne Brown, just did the math, and she has basically put this number out there back in 2002, and sure enough, that's kind of what it came to. So, what about Bidcorp and VanOck? Three levels of government, or is there any accountability? Remember, we were promised accountability. We would know, Jack Poole told us back in 2002, we would know where every penny went, every penny. I don't know that they've ever issued an audited financial. Again, members of the media, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think I'm wrong. Neither by Bidcorp or by VanOck. They continue to hold in-camera meetings. They are so secretive that they stopped reporting to the BC Secretariat for the Olympic Games because there would then be a paper trail. And in fact, the reason people started realizing they were not reporting is because they actually did access to information to the Secretariat who had no records because they weren't getting in. Outright, and I stress this word, outright fraud on security costs. There is no more charitable way to put it, and we'll talk about that in a second. At every level, they block access to information, so when citizens like me or the media or the state try and find out what's going on, it's remarkably difficult because they simply do not want to cough up the numbers. Working through access to information or freedom of information, depending on the level of government, is an exercise in frustration because they will make it as hard as possible to release information to you. They simply do not want you to know what they're doing. And frankly, outright deception and fraud in venue construction, and I'll highlight the Athletes Village, and the connection between the company that actually got the contract, Millennium, and their little shadow company called Armico Construction. We'll talk about that in a second. Social inclusivity was supposed to be a big part of the games. This is some of the lost costs. Social housing, there were going to be a minimum 250 units in the village. There were going to be jobs on the downtown east side. There was going to be community involvement in planning. Communities were going to be consulted. They were going to be involved in how security worked and how transportation worked. And what actually happened? Net loss of housing. And again, Laura can correct me if I'm wrong, increased homelessness, as we've already seen. I don't believe there's been any concerted job creation strategy for downtown Eastside. And communities, and I know this because I've been to some of these meetings, communities were never consulted about what the transportation plan or the security plan was going to be. Rather, Bud Mercer of the Integrated Security Unit and Steve Sweeney from the VPD show up and tell you what's going to happen. They're not consulting you, they're telling you. Some of the homeless people, this fellow named Cameron Bishop, who lives down on Canby Street. Greenest games ever. Again, this comes back to the whole notion of cost. What do these things cost? What is the cost of 5,000 old growth arbutus trees? Well, you could probably put a number on it. I would suggest the cost is far more. It is a negative legacy, if you will. It is it may be intangible to some people, but one of the last arbutus forests on the South Coast destroyed for a four-lane highway. Endangered species habitat destroyed at Larson Creek. Thousands of trees cut down in the Sea to Sky. Mount Cypress, more trees down. The Callahan, we don't really know how many trees came down. Much of it was old growth. The estimates based on the number of trucks that came out of there laden with logs could be somewhere in the 40,000 range, could be higher. Much of it was old growth. So habitat destruction, red listed species in both places, and carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide, what price can you put on carbon dioxide? When the amount of carbon dioxide created by the games for people coming into the city, for the construction projects that go on, for the transportation and all the things that happen, is something like 3.5 megatons. 10 times higher than the Suzuki Foundation estimated, but that's because the Suzuki Foundation didn't count construction. Higher than 77 countries on this planet for a 17-day party, mind you. And equivalent to 5% of British Columbia's total output. So what is the cost of all that? That is part of the costs of the games. Some of the butcher's bill, this is what Eagle Ridge looked like before. That was in the construction, it's now a four-lane highway. This is a piece of the Callahan before and the trails they made through it. I should mention the trails are very wide, and paved. This is something called the Nestor Wetlands in Whistler. That was now going to be the site of the parking lot for the hydrogen buses that are going to be there. This little pile of slash is what used to be, what's going to be the Celebration Plaza for the medal ceremony in Whistler. It used to have 800 trees in the middle of the village. So what is the cost of that? So Vanek's response to all that was, well, you know, all that stuff is not so important because we're building all the buildings to LEED standards, so gold, platinum, whatever, so that takes care of that concern. They had a cute part of their, one of their first sustainability report. They said, we have this woody debris we have to get rid of. And so what's woody debris? Well, woody debris is all the stuff when you cut down 100,000 trees that's left over. So Vanek's solution was, we're not going to burn it because that's not green, and these are the greenest games ever. Our solution is we're going to bury it. Cool. Okay. So that's what they did with their woody debris. They invited different companies to do carbon offsetting. That's what Suzuki had recommended, although a lot of it hasn't happened, as far as we know. And again, they happily ignored 90% of the game's related emissions. And they, when they looked at Eagle Ridge Bluffs, as with all things Vanek-ish, it wasn't their fault. It was the Ministry of Transportation did it. Down on the east side, it's not their fault. It's the province did it. Or something, you know, someone always does it. They never do it. They're never responsible for it. So it's like you push a boulder off a cliff and it goes downhill and kills somebody. Hey, it's a boulder. You notice I didn't do it. I tripped. And this brings us to another cost. What is the cost of securing the games? Is it worth the price? This is the cover article in a May's Briar Patch magazine that Alyssa and I wrote. And it raises the question of how much are we paying for security and what are we giving up for security? What is the cost if we give up civil liberties? Is it worth it? Okay, not to mention the cost. Here's what they said. You get $175 million for the entire security package. That's everything. Nobody's going to be disrupted. Nothing. It's not going to happen. And no civil rights violations because this is Canada. You know, we have charter rights and freedoms, all that kind of stuff. So what really happened? Well, we know it's $1 billion. And that's what we know about. Again, we don't know the full cost. I've actually had one person tell me that they meaning ISU, which stands for the Integrated Security Unit, has no bottom line and don't know what it will really cost. And I believe that. Here's what the RCMP's own internal documents said about that number. This was a letter that Rob Harriman, who was the head of the ISU until a couple years ago, he wrote to Annette Antoniak, who was the head of the BC Secretary of the Olympic Games, and he said, the entire $175 million budget that Vanek had put forward was derived without consultation with the RCMP. The RCMP is a lead agency. How do you do that without talking to the RCMP? They did. And he said it was conceptual. Let's translate that. That means it was made up. BidCorp made the number up because they thought they could sell it to you. So are we, and we still don't know what the city of Vancouver spent. This billion is just federal and provincial money. Okay. Are they stupid or were they trying to fool you? And I would argue that is probably a little bit of both. We now know that, of course, the entire period of time from somewhere about January 20th until close to the end of March, roughly 60 days, a lot of our lives are going to be massively disrupted. What is the cost of the economic cost of that? If you can't get to your job, and John Furlong, the head of the CEO for BidCorp, or for Vanek, says, look, work from home, go on vacation. Yeah, but not everyone can do that, especially in hard economic times. If you can't do that, what's the cost? What is the cost for small merchants who are counting on the people who live here to go to their restaurants and go to their stores if they can't get to their businesses or people can't get to their businesses for 60 days? And I would suggest to you, a lot of them are going to be in very big trouble. Massive disruption, huge economic impact, far above what Vanek or the government would admit. And again, we've already seen it played out in Cambie. So imagine 60 days of you not being able to get to your business. 13,000 police and soldiers, probably as a minimum. We don't even know how many private security personnel are coming to town. Huge areas of Vancouver are going to be inaccessible. All the areas behind the major venues, GM Place, BC Place, all those are completely behind security lockdowns. If you don't have a ticket, you're not going there. Many roads have Olympic lanes only. You can only drive down those lanes if you are, for example, Broadway is going to have Olympic lanes. What that means is they're going to take a lane on each side, and it's going to be for the Olympics only. The other lanes are for you. Broadway has 4 lanes. That means you have 2. Okay. Now, how bad is it normally when you have 2 lanes? Pretty bad. So imagine now, Broadway's this way, Renfrew's completely cut off, Hastings is Olympic lanes, Second is Olympic lanes, etc. And this goes, and all the bridges are too. And the Lionsgate Bridge, and they haven't really come clean what's going to happen to the Lionsgate Bridge, but Lionsgate Bridge, last time I checked, had 3 lanes. Bob Mackins in the back, can correct me if I'm wrong, I think it has 3 lanes. If they take 2 for the Olympics, that leaves you 1. If you have 1 lane, and all you have to do is some fool, it does this every week, some fool stalls their car on one of the 3 lanes on the Lionsgate Bridge. And what happens? Traffic chaos. And everything backs up to the Second Narrows, where I have to go over. Okay, thank you very much. So now they're going to do this for 60 days. They're going to take 2 Olympic lanes. What do you think is going to happen? They're going to paralyze the city for anyone who lives in the North Shore. Civil rights violations. Okay. They told us this would never happen. It's already happening. We've seen it happen. It's been happening to members of the Olympic Resistance Network. They're doing things called identity checks. That's new in Canada. Well, actually, it's not new in Canada, but we, for those of us who are ignorant, it was new in Canada. I was actually stopped February 12th by a Vancouver police car outside of, just I was just off Three Vets in Yukon and Seven. And they pulled me over, and they wanted to know the identities of everyone in the car, including my passengers. Well, that turns out not to be legal, but they did it anyway. And they kept us for 40 minutes until the passengers coughed up their identifications. Identity checks in Canada. Okay. Cameras going everywhere, and apparently many of them staying. Active campaign to target activists. And now they're really casting a very wide net. Now they're starting to go out and find our friends and our families. They've talked to my friends. They've talked to my ex-wife, which is interesting. And they're out there cruising around for anything they can get. And ambush marketing. And what's coming down now is the so-called the Nimbus Olympic marketing byline. What's that correct term? What's it called? Vision Nimbus. Whatever it is, whatever they're calling it. Basically, it says, remember, there's not going to be any civil rights violations in Canada. It says, you can protest, but you can't have a sign with a stick on it. Because a stick could be a weapon. Your sign can't block anything. Okay. You can't use a voice amplification device. You can't interfere with anyone's enjoyment of the games. What kind of protest are we having here? So the answer to that is probably going to be, but we're building you protest pens. We're building you little protest areas. One of them is going to be up here at the Thunderbird, you know, the Thunderbird Stadium. We don't know exactly where. One is at Hillcrest. One is at Hastings Park. And you can protest there. And they're building something there. We don't know what they're building, but we've actually seen the documents. They actually have a build-out period for Hastings Park of 13 days. Like, what do you need to build in 13 days? What? Like, police tape and, you know, a couple of those sawhorses, you know, around a little park would kind of do it. But no, they're building something for us. Because they have to make sure that the marketing rights that the city has signed with the IOC are not violated in any conceivable way. So for the city of Vancouver, with this law, the rights of the IOC and their commercial interests utterly trump the Supreme Law of Canada, which I have been brought up to believe was the most fundamental document we have in this country that guarantees our civil rights. That doesn't count anymore. What is the cost of that? And I would suggest to you that the cost is far more than a monetary one. It is, in fact, a fundamental one. Let's have a fast look at Olympic security costs. Olympic security costs. One of the reasons we know that the entire story was nonsense. One of the things I do, as Alyssa mentioned, in my other world is I'm a scientist and I graph stuff. So I figured I would just throw some numbers on the graph and see where it came out. So what you see is for many years, and these are probably slight underestimates, but for many years the cost of Olympic security hovered around $100 to $200 million. Okay. Took a big jump in 2002. This turns out not to be correct, by the way. This we just found out that this was more like, it wasn't $400 million, it was about $1.3 billion, so it's somewhere up in there. So here are your 3 points. There's $1.3 billion, this is about $1.5 billion in Athens, this is about $1.4 billion in Torino. China was, you know, you can't even make the scale big enough. We know that London is out here, and I didn't graph it. This is from my book. London is somewhere up in here. It's well over $1 billion. And they haven't even added the military costs yet. And here's Vancouver coming in with their 175.7. That's what we call an anomaly, a statistical anomaly. And so when you look at that thing like that, and you say, how did you possibly get this out of, didn't you guys do this graph? Like, how could you not do this? I mean, how did you possibly get that number? And I think the short answer is they cribbed it, as when you see graphs like this, you know they cribbed it, okay? And then, of course, you get the true value. It's going to cost $1 billion. And again, that's probably an underestimate. Because it takes a lot of time and a lot of money for the ISU investigators to go track down my personal friends, because God knows what they might be planning, and you know that's driving the budget higher and higher. And I think a lot of those zeros coming from that. And then we now know, this is an article that Bob Mackin wrote. We now know that the actual governments of various levels, provincial and federal, actually knew this for a long time. So when they admitted it in February 2009, that, yeah, it was probably going to be $1 billion, they'd been well aware of that for an awfully long time. In fact, there's a letter from ISU chief Bud Mercer to, I can't remember to whom, to someone else, basically saying, yeah, how are we going to manage this? How are we going to finesse this small problem that we have that we've been sitting on this number for a long time? And that essentially we've known since 2003 that the $175 million is utter nonsense. So they basically tried to keep it under wraps as long as they could and then had to admit that they had actually misled the public for a long time. Then this is the interesting part. This is where Vancouver gets in trouble. This is the Athletes' Village. And this is one of the things that I confess I got wrong in my book. I got this wrong. I could not imagine how you could be handed this golden gift of developing the Athletes' Village and you could so utterly screw it up. I couldn't have screwed it up that bad. It's unbelievable, and we'll see why. So this is Millennium Water, the green waterfront community that a company called Millennium is building. So an obscure company called Millennium, run by two brothers, gets the village deal, beats out four other companies for it. The other companies are actually fairly well known. This happens in April 2006. Their history is unknown. Their capitalization is completely opaque, and their structure is not clear. It consists of the two brothers. They have this link, and you can actually go see it for yourself. You can walk down to a place called the Province Building on the corner of Cambie and Hastings. You can walk in. There's a little plaque on the door, and it says Millennium Development Corporation and Armico Construction. Armico Construction is a shell company. The two brothers used to be the directors of this. The current director of this is a fellow who was the president of the Nonpartisan Association. Nonpartisan Association, until the last election, ran the city. They deny, of course, that there's any funny business, that there's any sort of link between the two. Although, and then, in fact, these two brothers, Sharon and Peter Malik, denied that they actually knew Paul Bourbeau, even though they could have thrown spitballs at each other across the room. So how did they possibly not know about this? City staff denied knowing this connection. Okay. City staff not knowing this connection is bad enough that there's a potential conflict of interest. But what else did the city not know? The city also didn't know that these guys were funding themselves through a hedge fund. Now, I don't know if you guys know about hedge funds and how you raise money for capital projects, but you can do various things. If you walk into a bank and say you want to buy a house, I can do it. I'm a professor. I can go in there, and the bank might lend me the money, and they'll probably give me a reasonably competitive rate. You guys, poor graduate students, probably will not get such a good rate. You might end up going to a mortgage broker, which is essentially what a hedge fund is, and they're going to give you a very different rate. So Millennium actually had to go to a hedge fund, which meant that their capitalization was terrible. And we've seen since the collapse of several projects. Okay, they were in trouble. How did the city not know that? And actually, the city did know that, and they went with them anyway. So here's what the deal looked like when it was founded. This Millennium was going to pay them $193 million for the land, only 30% down. The city then kicked in almost $160 million for site remediation, which is a lot. Okay. They were then going to pay the $82.5 million for the 250 units they were going to own, and they were going to put more money into it if the project got behind schedule. Okay, and to make it even sweeter, Millennium could pre-sell the units, which they started to do. The mortgage was held by Fortress Credit, a huge hedge fund. The city had provided, it turns out, through secret documents, $190 million in loan guarantees because this was such a risky, bloody thing. And Fortress Credit was very concerned about these guys. And then the city started pumping money into it, $100 million first and then more. This was interesting because David Eby, in 2007, got up in front of City Council, and he had actually come up with a plan. He said, look, to house the homeless in the city, you'd need about $300 million. Okay. And moreover, David came up with a number. He said, here's where you get it. Here's a series of places you can actually take this money to actually make this work. City Council basically said, well, we'd like to, but we can't. We don't have the money. And then when these clowns get into trouble, all of a sudden the city's finding money. Like, wow, $300 million. We'll toss money into, you know, $190 million loan guarantee, $100 million for the project, and more and more and more. So bad, in fact, that the city ended up taking over the mortgage from Fortress. They actually bought out the Fortress mortgage. So the city has now got over a billion dollar project that they are financially responsible for. City refuses to release details. Everything they've done has been essentially in camera. And of course, they claim that there would be profits when the village is sold, and there may well be. But remember, we're in a recession, market is soft, it's not likely to be soon. And what happens to social housing when that happens? What happens to the promise of 250 social units? This led to a whole series of city officials, the city manager, and the project manager for the project, and a couple other people suddenly deciding that the grass looked greener somewhere else and they wanted to wander off and go do something else. And then remember when I said the city didn't have any money? Because David Eby had also suggested that you could take some of this money from the property endowment fund. The property endowment fund for the city, essentially the city's piggy bank, that's estimated somewhere between, let's say, $2 billion for just to round it off. And of course the city said, oh, we don't have that money. But when Millennium got in trouble, they instantly had the money and they took it out of the property endowment fund. So here, what is the overall cost to Vancouver? Remember, this is not the $6 billion yet. This is just the city of Vancouver. Venues are probably $100 million over with all the venues that the city has been involved in. The Athletes Village, an exposure of about $1 billion, $1.1 billion. Now, let's say they're going to recoup some of that money, and so maybe the money, the loan guarantee comes back, so it's only $800 million, not $1.1 billion. They've already poured $320 million into the RAV line. Security, they won't tell us, we don't know, but it's not going to be trivial. Every time city council sits down, it's like drunken sailors on shore leave. They're buying big screen TVs, they're celebration centers, flags are going up, it goes on and on. So the final tab for Vancouver. Remember, the province is not bailing them out on this. The final tab for Vancouver could be $1.5 billion, okay, plus change. The endowment fund, and this is where the city council gets a little squirrely, the endowment fund 2 years ago was estimated $2.7 billion, and that was Peter Ladner and Sam Sullivan. Sam Sullivan being the mayor at the time. Now, Ken Bain, who's the acting director of financial services, says, well, you know, maybe it's really like $1.4 billion. Well, $1.4 billion in your overall property endowment fund, which is your piggy bank, versus $1.5 billion possible security overall a taxpayer cost, you're skating pretty close to the edge, I think. So maybe we wish you had the money back. Current projected federal deficit is $50 billion. Province of BC came in at about $2.8 billion deficit. And of course, the inevitable consequences of when you do that is you start to see this kind of stuff. So we also know in the last few weeks that the province is cutting back on after-school sports programs, and they're cutting back on all kinds of things. All the cultural stuff is being cut back as well because they don't have as much money. Gee whiz, I wonder if there's any correlation between that and the previous thing. I want to touch upon London 2012 just very briefly, because London 2012 is very symptomatic of the overall problem for Olympic Games in general. And it answers our question, do Olympic Games make us money? So here is basically Vancouver's operating costs, about $1.7 billion, $1 billion in security, and London operating costs a little bit higher, about £2 billion, and their overall costs of about £9 billion sterling, which is about $16-17 billion Canadian. And the security costs, again, are pegged at $600 million, which is almost over $1 billion. Okay. 2007, the RAND Corporation did a study for the London organizers. And it basically said, can we find out if the games are actually going to make us money? And they had a few key points. And they basically noted that in past games, the analyses that had been developed to decide if the games are going to make money used greatly simplified models in the economy in question rests on unsound assumptions or limited information. Yeah, that's true. And they then stated, it is surprising how little research has revisited ex ante studies to assess their predictions in light of actual events. In other words, very few times have they actually gone back to see if the rosy projections had actually come true. Benefits were overestimated, for sure, and that there were gaps between benefits and the ensuing legacies. So then they looked at the issue of whether or not London as a destination city would actually make money because it would become more of a world-class city. And they said, well, actually, London's already on the map, as by the way is Vancouver, as by the way is Chicago. So when you already have saturated the market, how much more can you possibly put into it? If you're Lillehammer or Albertville in France, or name some other place that's never, Calgary, that most people haven't heard of, you might get a tourist bump out of it. But if you're Vancouver, if Whistler's already the top number one ski resort destination in North America, how much more are you going to get? And the answer is, according to RAND Corporation, not much. We got these kind of quotes coming from London. Of course, the list of benefits to the rest of the UK are endless. Of course they are. The big picture is benefits right across the board. Sebastian Coe, Lord Coe, is the head of LOCOG, the London Organizing Committee for Olympic Games. And these are not going to be just London's games. Don't these sound very familiar? And especially they sound really familiar to people in Prince George and other parts of this province who were told these are going to be British Columbia's games, Canada's games. Everyone's going to get a piece of this pie. And of course, then we get these headlines that they didn't really want to see, etc. And you can read them for yourselves. And, and this is just a small sampling that I took just before I went to England in June. They did an economic study in England before the games were awarded. They asked this fellow, Adam Blake, who's a professor of economics, what would actually happen? What was, again, he did an economic impact statement. So what would actually happen? Would the regions outside of London actually make any money? And he went and did the calculation. He said, well, London could make money if everything goes just perfectly. But everything else, all the resources and the money and the jobs get sucked into London, and the rest of the country loses economically. It's just, there's no economic benefit for the rest of it. And so he said, in the best case, London was going to make about £6 billion, and the rest of the country was going to lose £4 billion. Now, this part turns out not even to be true, but you can see that the rest of the country was going to actually lose money. And again, there are a lot of similarities to what we see here in British Columbia. What did I want to take out of this? Oh yeah, the government actually knew this. They had known this before they won the bid, and they concealed it from the public until after they had won the bid, until 6 months later, and then they actually hid it in a report called, and under a paragraph called "Every Corner of the Country to Feel the 2012 Effect." They just didn't say in that headline what that 2012 effect was going to be. So at the same time in March in 2009, this year, Olympics Minister Tessa Jowell had to finally admit that the $2.4 billion sterling cost was actually $9.3 billion, of which British taxpayers would pay the bulk of it, and they actively went through a whole series of steps to conceal this from the public for as long as possible. Who knew about it? Well, Tessa Jowell did, and the fellow who used to run the woman of the finance department, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, who happens to be the current Prime Minister, he knew about it too. So where are they going to take some of their shortfall money? Well, they're going to pull it out of lottery, going to take it from arts and culture, heritage, sport. Interesting, they're taking it from sport, considering the Olympics is supposed to be about sport and helping people live healthier lifestyles. And that's what they're going to do. So the similarities between Vancouver 2010 and London 2012, both started with extreme low-ball budgets that were and known at the time to be fraudulent. Both made financial promises that were completely unrealistic. Vancouver from $660 million to $6 billion, again, that being a likely low estimate. For, remember, this is what they thought they were going to get back. Okay, so in the best of cases, this was not going to be a money winner. And again, the supposed economic outcome for the benefit of London, 5.9 billion sterling for an overall expenditure of 9.325 billion. They hid the true cost from the public. Access information works about as badly in Britain as it works here. Cost escalation was not in spite of what the organizers tell you, because steel and concrete suddenly became vastly more expensive by a factor of 4. That's not true. Why? Because if they had told people the truth in London or in Vancouver, no one would have gone for it. You wouldn't have accepted the games. And Vanhock, Bidcorp, absolutely, utterly deceived the public about security costs. And the city of Vancouver hid athletes' village costs and continues to do so. So it comes back to our initial question: does hosting the Olympics help or hurt an economy? So if you were going to help the economy, what would you want to do? Long-term jobs for people, it would be a key stimulus expenditure. You'd want to develop infrastructure with long-term, widespread benefits. So, for example, when Obama talks about building a light rail system across the United States, that's probably a good idea. That might accomplish both of those tasks. Will building Olympic venues do the same thing? Are they high labor-intensive projects or high capital-intensive projects? And the answer is they are high capital-intensive projects that benefit relatively few people. I don't know about you guys, but I'm probably unlikely to use the luge run in the rest of my life. That doesn't mean some of you might not, but would you really want to have spent $90 billion for it? What is the impact of the economic construction and security on ordinary businesses? During construction, small businesses get hurt. We've seen it with the Canby line. During the games, security closures affect small and many sizes of businesses because people can't get to them. People can't get to work. And there's no compensation being offered by any level of government. And when they talk about all the tourists coming in who are going to spend like madmen in your city, first of all, they're not going anywhere else. Number two, there's also this whole thing called outflow. Now, there's a lot of people, a lot of my friends, are leaving. They don't want to have any part of this circus. They don't want to be part of the transportation lockdowns. They don't want to be the fact that they can't get to their jobs or the business, or they can't get the kid to the dentist. They want to be somewhere else. So they leave the city and they leave the business they normally spend their money in, and the tourists don't necessarily balance that. So the outflow can actually cost more money. And when you actually have the outflow, when 100,000 Vancouverites or whatever the number is, 10,000, whatever that number is, when they go to Mexico, whose trade balance improved? Well, not Canada's, it was Mexico's, I would suggest. And then something that Vancouver's various levels of government don't like to talk about, and Vanna will surely never talk about this, but what are the opportunity costs? In other words, what would you have done with the $6 billion, or in the case of London, $16 billion, if you weren't spending it on a party? Well, for example, we had a few things that might have needed our attention. The pine beetle catastrophe that has decimated a lot of the province. By the way, in case you don't know it, it's over because the pine beetles ate all the pine trees they could eat. So there's no longer a pine beetle infestation because the pine beetles are all dying. Except that they've jumped the Rockies and now into the arboreal forest in Alberta and elsewhere. Terrific. So science-based efforts to actually stop the pine beetle infestation might actually have done some good back in 2002. And would it have cost $6 billion? No. It would have cost a lot less. But they didn't do it. So the industry, the forestry industry, is in big trouble in this province, I think most of you know. Fishery is in big trouble in this province. We have not done a lot to create an alternative energy industry, and I'm not counting run-of-the-river thing as being part of a positive solution. We did not invest in education subsidies or buildings. We didn't build any more universities. We didn't build any more hospitals. We didn't do much about the homelessness and poverty in the city in general, let alone the downtown east side. We certainly did not create long-term opportunities for Native people besides dancing for the tourists when they come in 2012. And in my own field, disease prevention and cure, the Olympic $6 billion is 10 years of national health research funding. 10 years. Gone for a 17-day party. Okay. And that $6 billion would cure or at least give you a big jump up on all these things. All the things that are ultimately going to kill most of us if we don't get run over by buses, cardiovascular, diabetes, cancer, neurological disease. Where neurological diseases alone, North American economy, they cost North American economy, Canada and the United States, $500 billion a year. So if you could knock that down by 10%, think what the savings in human suffering and the economy would be. That you could have done for $6 billion. So those are some of your opportunity costs. Chicago found out on Friday that they are very lucky people. They ducked the bullet. Their mayor had gone down there claiming that it would cost no taxpayer money. And then he signed a deal with the IOC about 2 months ago, where he basically agreed to cover any cost overruns. The bid group had said that it was going to cost $5 billion U.S. to host the games, and that was all going to be private sector money, which was kind of a remarkable statement for Mr. Daley to be making, considering that every summer games in recent memory has been in the multiple billion-dollar range, somewhere between $15 to $20 billion. We're not even counting what China spent, because no one knows. Their athlete's village cost was curious because they said it's going to cost like $800 million, which is odd because a summer athlete's village is roughly three times a winter athlete's village, and concrete is concrete and steel is steel. So why would theirs cost less than ours? It didn't make a lot of sense. And they had the other problem that they hadn't costed in security, and the state of Illinois, unlike our province, was not backing, although it was officially backing the bid, it was backing it with Chicagoans' money. So Chicagoans realized that they were in huge trouble if they actually got it, and if things in Chicago actually went the way they normally go in Chicago, where they don't deliver stuff on time and budget. Anyway, and to make it even funnier, is they actually, a lot of the opposition to the games actually came about because the bid organizers went hysterical last January. There was a group called No Game Chicago. No Game Chicago basically was going to put on a small forum in January. The bid organizers went hysterical and emailed 10,000 of the followers to show up at that forum and shut it down, which generated a lot of media attention, which all of a sudden created the notion in people's minds that there actually is an opposition, which is something you don't want to ever do. So a combination of these factors, arrogance, corruption, and the reliance on superstars such as Obama and Oprah Winfrey failed to bring the games to Chicago. So summary, who benefits? The private sector does, Jack Poole did, and other developers, but it's a limited one. The IOC made out like bandits. Who loses? There's from an article by Bruce Constantino from the Vancouver Sun. Here's the kind of people who tend to take the whack for this: taxpayers, small businesses, etc. Of course, goes without saying the poor do. The environment does. Civil liberties do. with police surveillance and ambush marketing bylaws, which are totally trampling our rights and freedoms. So do Olympics help or hurt an economy? I think they're actually a killer of an economy. I think this is an economic train wreck. And if you have a recession already, you want that money. You don't want to be pouring it into this. This is actually going to make it a lot worse. So it generates debt, as we've seen from that article that came out on Thursday. Hard economic times, it makes it vastly worse. And to summarize, Colin Hanson is really has no idea what he's talking about. So I'd like to finish by thanking various people, my co-convener, Alyssa, Green College, Principal Mark Dussey, and Kelly and Alan, wherever they are, members of the ORN, the different groups I've worked with, 2010 Watch, Workless Party, other Olympic Watchdog groups, friend Danica, my daughter Emma, Tim, Conrad, Megan, Linda, who's not here, and friends and family, and thank you very much for your time.